Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners. Hello, and welcome to As It Is, the current events program for podcast and broadcast from VOA Learning English. On today's program, we tell you about an armed group of ranchers who have occupied federal land in the western state of Oregon. Later on the program, we will tell you about some of the reaction to comments people believed were from the leader of the Oregon occupation protest. Remember, we always present these stories at a slower speed so you can understand if English is not your first language. And we try to use words, sentences, and paragraphs that are written especially for people who are learning English. Now, about the situation in Oregon. The armed protesters continue to occupy a U.S. National Wildlife Refuge in the western state of Oregon. Some experts say the protesters have been influenced by the extremist militia movement to fight against the federal government. The protesters moved in while the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge was closed during the New Year's holiday. The leader of the protest is Ammon Bundy. He is a rancher from Nevada. Bundy said the occupying group has named itself Citizens for Constitutional Freedom. Bundy said he wants the government to consider claims that federal officials have mistreated local ranchers. They are also bringing attention to the case of Dwight and Stephen Hammond. They are two Oregon ranchers who were found guilty of setting fires illegally on public land. The ranchers were ordered to return to prison after a judge found they had not served enough of their 5-year sentences. They have since returned to prison. Bundy has been involved in standoffs with government officials before. In 2014, Bundy, his father Cliven, and his brother took part in another armed standoff with federal officials. They had refused to pay money for grazing their cattle on federal land. The standoff ended when the U.S. government returned cattle to the family that it had seized. John Freemuth is an expert in land use at Boise State University in Idaho. He says the protesters are dealing with issues of concern to Western ranchers. The government controls huge areas of land in the Western United States. That includes more than half of the state of Oregon. Freemuth said there has been a change in public values about wildlife protection and public lands. He says this has left ranchers feeling squeezed by all these changes, new environmental laws, and they feel they're not listened to. The loosely organized occupation group has brought together people with many concerns, including gun rights. Oregon is one of 45 states with so-called open carry laws, which permit people to carry firearms. One protester, John Ritzheimer, has led armed anti-Islamic protests in his home state of Arizona. Ritzheimer posted an emotional declaration on YouTube warning that there's no stopping us. John Freemuth says most Oregonians are appalled at the confrontation. He says they consider the occupiers outside activists who have rolled in, armed and threatening, and have gone way beyond what the local folks are protesting. Ryan Lenz is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The organization studies extremist groups. Lenz says some ranchers who have real grievances with the federal government have been influenced by what he calls fringe ideologies. He says anti-government extremists should not control what is lawful in a country where we have a long-standing system of jurisprudence as organized by our courts. Rick Eaton is a researcher on extremist groups at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. He believes federal officials have shown restraint. Eaton says, to their credit, the government has backed off and has not created a standoff. Many standoffs end without violence or injury, such as the occupation in 1972 of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. Others, like one in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, in 1992, and another near Waco, Texas, ended with the deaths of civilians and federal agents. Sheriff David Ward of Harney County in Oregon addressed the armed protesters on Monday. He said, "It is time for you to leave our community. Go home to your own families and end this peacefully." You are listening to As It Is from VOA, Learning English. Next, we hear more about the story of ranchers occupying a wildlife refuge in Oregon. The story has spread on social media, but has raised questions. Ana Mateo tells us how the name of civil rights activist Rosa Parks became involved.
Maybe you are following the story about the men who are occupying a U.S. federal building in rural Oregon. Some believe that Ayman Bundy and his followers are taking a stand. This morning on Twitter, people expressed their outrage when a Twitter account that people thought belonged to Bundy compared what's happening in Oregon to what Parks did 60 years ago. Rosa Parks is a hero from the American Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s. Rosa Parks's name was mentioned on Twitter all day as people expressed their opinions. Gwen Ifill hosts a political talk show on PBS in the United States. She wrote, "I was so excited to see Rosa Parks trending, then cruel disappointment." But later in the day, people said they didn't think the account at Ayman_Bundy belonged to the militia leader. A reporter from the broadcaster MSNBC, who was following the story in Oregon, says Bundy does not have a Twitter account. Until then, several stories had already been written about Bundy's alleged comparison.
And that's our program for today. Keep listening for international news issues as we tell you about North Korea's recent claim that it has set off a hydrogen bomb. I'm Mario Ritter.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA, Learning English. This is In the News. The United States and South Korea have ordered their military forces on the Korean Peninsula on high alert following North Korea's nuclear test this week. On Thursday, the U.S. and South Korean defense ministers discussed measures to answer the latest nuclear test. South Korean Defense Minister Han Min-koo said, "Both ministers agreed that North Korea needs to pay the price for its provocation. North Korea is believed to have enough plutonium to make 8 to 12 nuclear weapons. Many security experts say that is more than enough to answer any supposed threat of invasion from the United States or South Korea." The North Korean government reportedly restarted a uranium enrichment center last year to produce more for nuclear weapons. The U.S.-based Institute for Science and International Security estimated that North Korea could have between 20 and 100 nuclear weapons by 2020. The test this week followed reports of a failed North Korean submarine-launched ballistic missile test. If North Korea could develop such a missile, it would have the ability to strike anywhere in the world, including the United States. North Korea continues to develop missiles with the ability to travel great distances. The country is believed to have 1,000 missiles that can reach targets in South Korea and Japan. "These aren't really so much for retaliation or defense anymore," said Robert Kelly, a North Korea expert with Pusan National University. "These are kind of like society-breaking weapons. If you drop a hydrogen bomb in Seoul or a couple on South Korea's big cities, you're not going to just kill a lot of people. You are also threatening the ability of North Korea to continue to function as a state." Some lawmakers in Seoul say South Korea should develop its own nuclear weapons to answer the growing nuclear threat from the North. There have also been calls in Seoul to set up a U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System. China reportedly opposes deployment of the system to East Asia because of concerns it could be used to stop Chinese missiles. Robert Kelly said he would like to see South Korea start taking THAAD more seriously. He said, "I would like to see the Americans and South Koreans and Japanese start really working seriously on regional missile defense. But you know, if we don't go down that route and diplomacy doesn't seem to be working, my sense is you will see people starting to call for airstrikes." Other observers said the United States should push for a wider economic action to punish North Korea. Robert Manning is with the Atlantic Council. He said, "Take away Kim Jong-un's credit cards. I think that would cause some real pain at a time when he has promised that his regime is going to improve the economy, which is a long shot to start with." U.S. and United Nations sanctions are already in place against North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un, for the country's earlier violations of nuclear treaties. Barry Bleckman is a national security expert with the Stimson Center. He said that, "We got the UN Security Council to establish tighter and tighter sanctions. We have gotten them pushed out of the international banking system. But it is still not enough so long as the Chinese continue to allow a kind of fundamental level of survival to continue there." He added that efforts to increase pressure on North Korea would have limited results until China fully honors existing international actions against the North. and that's In the News. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Last Leaf. It was written by O. Henry. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
Many artists lived in the Greenwich Village area of New York. Two young women named Sue and Johnsy shared a studio apartment at the top of a three-story building. Johnsy's real name was Joanna. In November, a cold, unseen stranger came to visit the city. This disease, pneumonia, killed many people. Johnsy lay on her bed, hardly moving. She looked through the small window. She could see the side of the brick house next to her building. One morning, a doctor examined Johnsy and took her temperature. Then he spoke with Sue in another room.
"She has one chance in, let us say, 10, he said. "And that chance is for her to want to live. Your friend has made up her mind that she is not going to get well. Has she anything on her mind?"
She wanted to paint the Bay of Naples in Italy someday, said Sue.
"Paint?" said the doctor. "Bosh! Has she anything on her mind worth thinking twice? A man, for example?"
"A man," said Sue, "is a man worth..." "But no, doctor, there is nothing of the kind."
"I will do all that science can do," said the doctor. "But whenever my patient begins to count the carriages at her funeral, I take away 50% from the curative power of medicines."
After the doctor had gone, Sue went into the workroom and cried. Then she went to Johnsy's room with her drawing board, whistling Ragtime. Johnsy lay with her face toward the window. Sue stopped whistling, thinking she was asleep. She began making a pen and ink drawing for a story in a magazine. Young artists must work their way to art by making pictures for magazine stories. Sue heard a low sound, several times repeated. She went quickly to the bedside. Johnsy's eyes were open wide. She was looking out the window and counting backward. 12, she said, and a little later, 11, and then 10, and 9, and then 8 and 7, almost together. Sue looked out the window. What was there to count? There was only an empty yard and the blank side of the house 7 meters away. An old ivy vine, going bad at the roots, climbed halfway up the wall. The cold breath of autumn had stricken leaves from the plant until its branches, almost bare, hung on the bricks. "What is it, dear?" asked Sue.
6, said Johnsy quietly. "They're falling faster now. 3 days ago, there were almost 100. It made my head hurt to count them. But now, it's easy.
There goes another one. There are only 5 left now.
5 what, dear? Asked Sue.
Leaves on the plant. When the last one falls, I must go too. I've known that for 3 days. Didn't the doctor tell you?
Oh, I never heard of such a thing, said Sue. What have old ivy leaves to do with your getting well? And you used to love that vine. Don't be silly. Why, the doctor told me this morning that your chances for getting well real soon were, let's see exactly what he said. He said the chances were 10 to 1. Try to eat some soup now, and let me go back to my drawing so I can sell it to the magazine and buy food and wine for us.
You needn't get any more wine, said Jauncey, keeping her eyes fixed out the window. There goes another one. No, I don't want any soup. That leaves just 4. I want to see the last one fall before it gets dark. Then I'll go, too.
Jauncey, dear, said Sue, will you promise me to keep your eyes closed and not look out the window until I'm done working? I must hand those drawings in by tomorrow.
Tell me as soon as you have finished, said Jauncey, closing her eyes and lying white and still as a fallen statue. I want to see the last one fall. I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of thinking. I want to turn loose my hold on everything and go sailing down, down, just like one of those poor, tired leaves.
Try to sleep, said Sue. I must call Mr. Behrman up to be my model for my drawing of an old miner. Don't try to move until I come back. Old Behrman was a painter who lived on the ground floor of the apartment building. Behrman was a failure in art. For years, he had always been planning to paint a work of art, but had never yet begun it. He earned a little money by serving as a model to artists who could not pay for a professional model. He was a fierce little old man who protected the 2 young women in the studio apartment above him. Sue found Behrman in his room. In one area was a black canvas that had been waiting 25 years for the first line of paint. Sue told him about Jauncey and how she feared that her friend would float away like a leaf. Old Behrman was angered at such an idea.
Are there people in the world with the foolishness to die because leaves drop off a vine? Why do you let that silly business come in her brain?
She is very sick and weak, said Sue, and the disease has left her mind full of strange ideas.
This is not any place in which one so good as Miss Jauncey shall lie sick, yelled Behrman. Some day I will paint a masterpiece, and we shall all go away.
Jauncey was sleeping when they went upstairs. Sue pulled the shade down to cover the window. She and Behrman went into the other room. They looked out a window fearfully at the ivy vine. Then they looked at each other without speaking. A cold rain was falling, mixed with snow. Behrman sat and posed as the miner. The next morning, Sue awoke after an hour's sleep. She found Jauncey with wide-open eyes staring at the covered window.
Pull up the shade. I want to see, she ordered quietly. Sue obeyed. After the beating rain and fierce wind that blew through the night, there yet stood against the wall one ivy leaf. It was the last one on the vine. It was still dark green at the center, but its edges were colored with the yellow. It hung bravely from the branch about 7 meters above the ground. It is the last one, said Jauncey. I thought it would surely fall during the night. I heard the wind. It will fall today, and I shall die at the same time. Dear, dear, said Sue, leaning her worn face toward the bed. Think of me, if you won't think of yourself. What would I do? But Jauncey did not answer. The next morning, when it was light, Jauncey demanded that the window shade be raised. The ivy leaf was still there. Jauncey lay for a long time looking at it. And then she called to Sue, who was preparing chicken soup. I've been a bad girl, said Jauncey. Something has made that last leaf stay there to show me how bad I was. It is wrong to want to die. You may bring me a little soup now. An hour later, she said, someday I hope to paint the Bay of Naples. Later in the day, the doctor came, and Sue talked to him in the hallway. Even chances, said the doctor. With good care, you'll win. And now I must see another case I have in your building. Behrman, his name is. Some kind of an artist, I believe. Pneumonia, too. He is an old, weak man, and his case is severe. There's no hope for him, but he goes to the hospital today to ease his pain. The next day, the doctor said to Sue, she's out of danger. You won. Nutrition and care now. That's all. Later that day, Sue came to the bed where Jauncey lay and put one arm around her. I have something to tell you, White Mouse, she said. Mr. Behrman died of pneumonia today in the hospital. He was sick only 2 days. They found him the morning of the first day in his room downstairs, helpless with pain. His shoes and clothing were completely wet and icy cold. They could not imagine where he had been on such a terrible night. And then they found a lantern, still lighted, and they found a ladder that had been moved from its place, and art supplies and a painting board with green and yellow colors mixed on it. And look out the window, dear, at the last ivy leaf on the wall. Didn't you wonder why it never moved when the wind blew? Oh, darling, it is Behrman's masterpiece. He painted it there the night that the last leaf fell.
You have heard the story, The Last Leaf, by O. Henry. Your storyteller was Barbara Klein. This story was adapted by Shelley Gullist and produced by Lawan Davis. I'm Faith Lapidus.